Living Ethically, Chapter 6, Mental States. Quote, having analysed well all deeds of body, speech and mind, those who realise what benefits self and others and always perform these are wise. End quote. This verse makes it clear that the full realisation of what benefits oneself and others comes from cultivating mindfulness, from having analysed well all deeds of body, speech and mind. That is, from being keenly aware at any given moment of whether what you are doing is beneficial or harmful. This aspect of mindfulness is sometimes called Dharma Vichaya, the investigation of mental states. Dharma here meaning a mental state, and it is an important part of Buddhist practice. In it, one constantly examines oneself, scrutinising one's deeds of body, speech and mind, and judging as far as one can whether they are skillful or unskillful, whether they have been prompted by kindness and wisdom, or by craving, hatred and delusion. In more general terms, the skillful is whatever pertains to the path and to the goal, whether directly or indirectly, while the unskillful is that which takes one off the path and out of sight of the goal. Here we are presented with another way of viewing ethical practice. But will such constant evaluation of our mental states not detract from our spontaneity? If you are forever stopping and analysing what you're thinking, doing and saying, are you not adopting a rather mechanical and even alienating attitude to your experience? Will it not make you too self-conscious to be able to live authentically? There is another question which needs to be dealt with first. Is it in fact true spontaneity that we value, or do we simply want to indulge instinctive and reactive behaviour? After all, our negative instincts and destructive habits are no less spontaneous than our creative impulses. If we just want to give free rein to all our different energies, we might as well forget about practicing mindfulness. This granted, it is nonetheless essential to stay in contact with the springs of one's creativity. Somehow you have to strike a balance between giving so much free rein to your instincts and energies that you lose all hope of being able to bring mindfulness to bear on them, and being so self-analytical that you simply inhibit and stultify yourself. Here the challenge is to be active and spontaneous and at the same time aware and mindful, so that there is a single mental and spiritual process in which awareness and spontaneity are indistinguishable. This is what happens when you are absorbed in work, for example. All your energy is going into the work, yet at the same time, you're very aware of what you're doing. With artistic or creative work, especially, is this the case. A unification of spontaneity and awareness can also take place in the course of human communication, when a real exchange of thoughts and feelings starts to flow between two people. It can happen in a crisis, or in a moment of danger, when all your energies are mobilised to meet an overwhelming challenge. Mindfulness demands the ability to immerse oneself in one's experience whilst at the same time being conscious of the nature of that experience. It is not a cold, objective, intellectual process, not a question of somehow standing outside one's experience and observing it. The awareness should infuse and inform the action or the speech or even the thought. It should do so, moreover, with a strong element of positive feeling, even joy. Mindfulness means that one is better able to decide whether or not to do something. If you are naturally a cautious, inhibited, self-controlled kind of person, you might try seeing what would happen if you were just to let rip. For some people, mindfulness might mean unbuttoning a little, taking a risk, and following a spontaneous impulse as a way of weakening their inhibitions. If, on the other hand, you are rather wild by nature and tend to be spontaneous in a purely instinctual and reactive way, mindfulness would involve restraining yourself and learning to curb your reactivity. Dharmavicaya does not mean breaking the flow of life by stopping at every turn in order to assess yourself according to some abstract notion of spiritual progress. It is simply a general awareness of how relatively skillful or unskillful any given action, thought, or utterance is, a sense of the extent to which you are moving towards a positive goal. You do not need to tear yourself up by the roots every few minutes to see if you've grown a little. Rather, you can make a start with Dharmavicaya by taking stock of yourself from time to time in order to ascertain the general direction of your actions of body, speech, and mind. Are they expressive of greed, hatred, and mental confusion, or expressive of generosity, kindness, and understanding? Then at some point, you need to embark upon the systematic development of moment-by-moment mindfulness and become more aware of your mental states as they arise, as well as aware of the direction in which any given mental state is heading. In this way, you will ensure that your confidence in what you are doing is sustained and that all the things you think and do and say contribute to the attainment of your goal. With practice, the analysis can become more searching. It is Dharmavicaya that leads to wisdom, not theoretical knowledge. Generally speaking, we understand intellectually far more than we are capable of putting into practice. After all, it is not so very difficult to take stock of one's actions of body, speech, and mind and judge whether or not they benefit oneself and others. But this is not enough. One has to live by the light of that knowledge. When it comes to putting what we know into practice, all sorts of conditions other than intellectual understanding, particularly habits, come into play. It is only by studying our actions and thoughts in detail, moment by moment, and seeing their effect upon us directly, that we will start to break down our habitual ways of responding to the world. Quote, "Then, having become a monastic, you should first be intent on the training in ethics. You should endeavour at the discipline of individual liberation, adhering frequently and delineating their meaning. Then you should forsake these which are called assorted faults. With vigour, you should definitely realise those renowned as the 57. Belligerence is a disturbance of mind. Enmity is a tight hanging on to that. Concealment is a hiding of ill deeds when confronted. Malevolence is to cling to ill deeds." End quote. Here, Nagarjuna recommends that the new monk should follow what I call the path of regular steps. However lofty and altruistic your goal, at the beginning of your spiritual career, you have to start by working on yourself, devoting yourself to your own individual liberation. No doubt, by getting on with your personal practice, you will have a positive effect upon others, but unless you gain a degree of insight, you will not be able to help them more radically. It might seem selfish just to persist with your own practice of meditation rather than teaching others, but in the long run, it is the depth of your meditative experience that's going to help you communicate the Dharma most effectively. Note that Nagarjuna is recommending taking up not the ideal of individual liberation, i.e. the Arhat ideal, but simply the discipline of individual liberation, i.e. the Pratimoksha. The ideal remains that of the Mahayana, not of the Hinayana, but for the time at least being, your discipline is that of individual liberation. In the same way, while true spontaneity may be your ideal, your present discipline might have to be quite strict, even narrow, if you are to achieve that ideal in the long run. There follows a touch of the Abhidharma, with a list of 57 unskillful mental states. It's not enough just to recognize the existence of these states in us. We have to bring mindfulness to bear on them. The purpose of our taking this long, hard look at the unskillful tendencies of our own mind is so that we may take steps to eradicate them and thus become, eventually, free from them. Anger comes first because it's from anger that resentment, hatred and enmity all arise. Being the direct opposite of the Bodhisattva's compassionate vow, these states are the most unskillful that we can experience. Anger is of a momentary and explosive nature, often being the result of a build-up of frustrated energy. You want something but you cannot get it, or you want to say something but you cannot say it. Eventually, you explode. Resentment or hatred is a more settled anger, the result of brooding over one's wrongs, real or imagined, so that one's mind is slowly poisoned. Enmity goes even further, being the persistent desire to harm another person. While hatred is a mental attitude, enmity consists in attempting actually to harm the object of your aversion, even over a period of years. It has been said that hatred is the experience of pain accompanied by the idea of an external cause. Hatred arises from the natural impulse to remove or counteract the person you have identified as the cause of your suffering, though they might not be responsible for it, or even aware of the fact that you think them responsible. But some hatred is gratuitous. Such hatred is termed malice, the delight in inflicting suffering on others for its own sake, regardless of whether they have done you any harm. Thus there is a hierarchy of negative emotions consisting of anger, hatred, enmity, and malice. Surprisingly enough, the greatest hatred often occurs between people who are supposedly very close to one another, between children and parents, between husband and wife, between people of the same religious tradition, and even between members of the same spiritual community. But these are the very people from whom we normally receive the most, emotionally speaking, and from whom we therefore expect the most. Bitter disappointment is thus more than likely. Another example is that of the welfare state, which was set up in Britain after the Second World War and which has given rise to a great deal of resentment. People have been gradually conditioned into thinking that everything should be provided for them. When it is not, or when what is provided is not to their liking, they feel they have been cheated of what was due to them, and become correspondingly angry. A lot of resentment and unfocused anger comes from having everything you really need and yet feeling deprived. This frustration and disappointment with a quite comfortable life is perhaps largely to do with spiritual deprivation. With no pressing material or physical needs, people are very quickly brought up against the basic question of what life itself is for, but without their having any real guidance on the subject. Our society has given us everything without telling us how to make the best use of it. the innumerable petty regulations imposed by the government irritate people and breed resentment. Mundane freedom may in the end feel like bondage, just as material wealth may feel like poverty. No wonder people feel angry and hard done by. The trouble is that utopia, which used to be in the future, has arrived now. If before the Second World War you'd told the average working class man or woman, especially the men in the long dole queues I saw in the 1930s, that in the future they would have a house of their own, a car, a television, new clothes every 6 months, a refrigerator and a washing machine, exotic ready-made meals and foreign holidays, and all for only 5 days' work each week, they would have said, "That will be heaven. What more could you want?" But it has not worked out like that. People feel cheated of the happiness that should have been theirs. They feel cheated because they have got what they were promised without the happiness they assumed would accompany it. The opposite of anger is patience, the capacity to endure difficulties or unpleasant situations without falling into or expressing negative emotions. Expressions like, "My patience snapped," which ought to be a confession of weakness, are more often meant to be self-exculpatory, as if no one could be expected to be patient beyond a certain point. Initially, one who takes the practice of ethics seriously will feel disappointed, even frustrated, when hatred or craving or jealousy arises. You now know the harm these emotions can do, and yet they keep on arising. Rather than allowing yourself to be discouraged by this, you should remind yourself that the fact that you can recognize them for what they are means that you are on the way to overcoming them. If you indulge them, living with them easily, and if you ignore their malign influence, you are inviting them to arise again in the future. But if you can see them for what they are, you should also be able to see that simply berating yourself on their account only makes things worse. Gradually, you will learn how to deal with these negative emotions as soon as they arise. For example, an angry thought or even a spontaneous outburst of anger is not necessarily a breach of your promise to generate compassion in place of ill will. In all likelihood, you did not deliberately make yourself angry. The anger simply erupted owing to a long-standing lack of attention to your mental condition, possibly allied to a fiery temper. The promise is broken when you indulge anger and make no effort to eradicate it. If you take no positive steps to overcome it when it arises, you are in effect encouraging it to do so again. At bottom, anger is the product of frustrated desire. So a simpler lifestyle, if it is embraced happily, should have the effect of making anger and hatred less likely to arise. Because hatred is intimately linked with craving or covetousness, it is always worth looking for its roots in frustrated desire. To take an obvious example, the nagging, restless itch of sexual craving can disturb our emotional balance, rob us of our peace of mind, and leave us discontented at best, and at worst full of jealous fury. Unfortunately, contemporary popular culture offers a constant invitation to indulge our many cravings, including sexual craving, and a spiritual practitioner has therefore all the more need to observe the ethical precepts. But if we are genuinely to observe them, we have to be able to find interest and pleasure and beauty elsewhere than in the objects of craving. Bringing an element of friendliness and concern into our personal relationships can provide a degree of genuine emotional sustenance, the lack of which often lies at the root of our frustration and bitterness. Much of the time, what we are really looking for is this kind of sustenance. Another approach is the aesthetic one, the more our emotions are engaged with and refined by poetry and the fine arts, or by devotional practices, the less likely it is that we will be troubled by the grosser forms of craving and hatred. The key is to broaden and deepen our interests, to cultivate contentment, and to adopt a more aesthetic attitude to life. Admire the flower in the crannied wall by all means, but be aware of your desire to pluck it out of the crannies, and without ceasing to appreciate its beauty, relax and relinquish your desire to possess it. Quote, arrogance is haughtiness due to wealth and so forth. Non-conscientiousness is non-application at virtues. Pride has seven forms, each of which I will explain. Fancying that one is lower than the lowly, or equal with the equal, or greater than or equal to the lowly, all are called the pride of selfhood. Boasting that one is equal to those who by some good quality are superior to oneself is called exceeding pride. Fancying that one is superior to the superior, thinking that one is higher than the very high, is pride beyond pride. Like sores on an abscess, it is very vicious. Conceiving an eye through obscuration in the five empty aggregates, which are called the appropriation, is said to be the pride of thinking I. Thinking one has won fruits of the spiritual path, yet not attained, is pride of conceit. Praising oneself for faulty deeds is known by the wise as erroneous pride. Deriding oneself, thinking I am useless, is called the pride of inferiority. Such is a brief description of the seven prides. End quote. Success is always dangerous. From a spiritual point of view, failure has its rewards, but worldly success tends to produce what the ancient Greeks called hubris, the pride that comes before a fall. Thoughtless or unmindful pride brings inflation, the sense that you can do nothing wrong. You become careless. You think nothing can stand in your way. When this happens, you will either have your inflated ego abruptly punctured, or it will suffer a slow, gradual deflation. Either way, you will be brought down to earth, and this will make you angry. You will think you were brought down by people who were jealous of you and your success, who could not bear their own comparative mediocrity. In this way, you become more and more blind to what is really going on. And even when you have achieved something worthwhile, this blindness can detract from the positive nature of the achievement. Haughtiness is thinking a lot of oneself and adopting a posture of superiority towards other, whereas arrogance goes further and involves trying to force people to recognise that superiority. In some societies, for example in the old Tibet, arrogance and haughtiness seem to have been considered positive qualities. When some of my Tibetan friends in Kalimpong wanted to speak well of an aristocratic lady, for example, they would say in tones of admiration, "She's really haughty," as if haughtiness were the crowning virtue. When pride includes self-denigration, we have to broaden the meaning of the term. Insisting on being equal to others is pride. Even humility, if it is at all self-conscious, is pride. According to Nagarjuna, belief in a separate, unchanging self is pride. Any way in which we fix or inflate our sense of self or separate ourselves from others by thinking that we are someone special is pride. You can be proud of a quality you have. You can be proud of a quality you do not have but think you have, and you can be proud of a quality you pretend to have. You might be genuinely learned or enjoy an effective meditation practice or even experience a degree of insight. All these can be accompanied by arrogance or inflation. You might, on the other hand, genuinely believe yourself to be enlightened, say, or that you were a great painter, when in fact you were nothing of the kind. You might even allow people to believe you possess certain spiritual attainments when you knew you did not really have them. All this is pride. People will take pride in almost anything that might bring them a little attention, even if that attention is far from flattering. Some are proud of being good liars or successful cheats, or of how drunk they can get. Others are proud of being useless, at least in certain respects. The latter may be dressed up as self-deprecation. Such people will say, "I'm afraid I'm absolutely hopeless at anything technical," with a rather boastful air, as if to say, "My mind is on higher things." Pride is about measuring ourselves against others, and it might seem that ideally we should not compare ourselves with others at all. However, we can hardly avoid doing so. We need to compare our abilities with those of other people from time to time for various purposes. But comparisons can be made skillfully or unskillfully. An unskillful comparison consists in being neurotically concerned to find a place for oneself in relation to others, in order to feel secure. You are anxious to know where you stand, whether you are equal, inferior, or superior to others. You might insist on being equal because really you feel insecure and in fact are constantly comparing yourself with others to your own detriment. A more positive form of comparison would be to ascertain where you stood in relation to others for the purpose of mutual growth and communication, and to achieve common objectives. Regarding someone as inferior to you does not necessarily mean that you look down on them. It could mean that you recognise that you can do more for them than they can do for you. Conversely, looking up to someone need not mean that you grovel. Boasting consists in overemphasizing one's own abilities in relation to those of others. Usually, it's simply a case of saying, "He may be a better carpenter than I am, but I'm better at public speaking." And a little awareness should prevent us from making too much of such relative advantages. Sometimes one person might be obviously superior to another in a general way, but given a change in circumstances, the situation can be swiftly reversed. In J.M. Barrie's play The Admirable Crichton, a group of aristocrats are shipwrecked on a desert island, and the eponymous manservant shows himself to be vastly superior to everyone else in the party. It is obvious that the Buddha was superior to the notorious bandit Angulimala, for example. Even so, it needs to be made clear that banditry is not the point of comparison between them, for this would make Angulimala better than the Buddha. That aside, we can say with confidence that the Buddha was a better man than Angulimala. However, as soon as Angulimala becomes enlightened, the difference between them immediately becomes much less. Comparisons of this kind are thus, if not odious, at least otios. At one time, you might be in a position to help a particular person. At another time, it might be you who needs the help and they who give it. There are always inequalities between people, and these need to be acknowledged if there is to be mutual helpfulness, but in the end, they are not what matters most. Nowadays, the general attitude towards the comparison of one person with another is rather strange. On the one hand, a professional has his or her performance judged and measured against that of other professionals. On the other, there is widespread resistance to the idea that one person might be better than another in a more general way. The truth is that we should go down on our knees in gratitude to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for the fact that we are not superior to all others, and that there are some people who are far better than we are at the vital business of being human. If there are those to whom we can look up, there is hope for us in our own future development, as well as help. Pride can also be collective. It can take the form of nationalism, for example, which is an extension of the pride of the individual, the pride that says, I. Pride is a versatile, many-sided fault, and it is hardly to be expected that one will altogether escape it this side of enlightenment. Pride is not always negative. As a positive quality, it comes under the heading of apatrapya, otapa in Pali, conscience or self-respect. This kind of pride, radically transformed, is an important element in the Vajrayana. There, the practitioner is recommended to think, how can I, being in my essential nature a Buddha, behave unskillfully? Is it in accordance with my Buddha nature? Could a Buddha behave in this way? Is it possible? This Buddha pride, as it is called, is a rather dangerous attitude for one to adopt. You could tell yourself more modestly, not that you were a Buddha, but that you belong to the Buddha's spiritual family. You might say, how could I think of doing anything unskillful when I have been adopted into the family of the Buddha? Or even, I am a child of the Buddha. How could I disgrace my own father by behaving badly? Hand in hand with this kind of positive pride goes respect for the good qualities of others. In an earlier passage, Nagarjuna has spoken of honouring the honourable, an expression which brings us up against a peculiarly modern wrong view. Today, the idea that one should reverence that which is worthy of reverence is rather foreign to us. People tend to be suspicious of anything which to them smacks of elitism. Since Freud, we have become very mistrustful of those who seem too good to be true, and we are only too aware that greatness may well conceal great weakness. Great achievements are often seen as compensations for the failure to address a deep emotional need. Along with this perception goes an urge to cut down to size anyone who succeeds in rising above the common herd. In the past, people were accustomed to look up to those in positions of social or political authority in much the same way that they looked up to God. Now all that has gone. God is not worshipped as widely as before, and most people have completely lost the habit of looking up. Yet William Blake very truly observed that worship of God is honouring his gifts in other men, each according to his genius, and loving the greatest men best. The same should go for us. If we really worship the Buddha, we will worship the spirit of his teaching wherever it manifests. We are quick to expose hypocrisy, to ridicule solemnity, and to bring pomposity down to earth. We like to insist that our own opinions are no less valid than anyone else's. We pride ourselves on not towing the party line, on sticking to our own point of view. It is difficult for us to appreciate how great a shift this represents from the attitude that prevailed until the middle of the 20th century. People were then more prepared to set aside their own personal, and thus necessarily limited and partial, views and interests out of respect for the supposedly better informed judgments of those in authority. They took pride in doing their duty. Nagarjuna's honouring the honourable should be rendered as respecting the respectable. And this shows us how alien such deference is to contemporary thinking. But what are we left with if we refuse to look up to anyone, and if we are so satisfied with our present level of understanding that we cannot imagine anything surpassing it? In fact, human beings have a deep-seated need to worship, so that we will inevitably look for someone or something to meet that need. But sometimes we set up idols only to cast them down and trample upon them. Moreover, we remain enthralled to group evaluations, except that nowadays those evaluations are often devaluations. Our cynical assumption is that the more we know about people, the less we will find to respect. We assume that what we do not know must be discreditable. In fact, while some of what we do not know may indeed be discreditable, there is much that is good which, being beyond our ken, we are simply unable to appreciate. As Coleridge said, we can reverence only what we do not understand. One would have thought that people would prefer to look up rather than to look down. But in cynicism there is more satisfaction for the ego, for we then feel that we know everything worth knowing about people and ideas and can reassure ourselves that no one is better than we are. We are capable of acknowledging someone's mastery in certain areas, so long as we can shake our heads over their failings in others. Probably, it is the fear of seeming naive and gullible, as much as anything, that prevents us from looking up to anyone. The Buddhist approach is always to examine the mental state behind any attitude, and from this point of view, a knowing cynicism is no better than starry-eyed idolization. To take the most obvious example of human greatness, that of the Buddha himself, do we revere him as a Buddha? Or do we see him as just one of us, as human and therefore flawed? Of course, he was a human being, but not just a human being. His being human does not make him less of a Buddha. Indeed, his humanity is part of his Buddhahood. It is not easy for us to see his humanity and his enlightenment at the same time. But if we are able to do so, we will see him more truly and therefore reverence him more deeply. Likewise, while it does a disservice to the memory of any great individual to ignore the weaknesses that testify to their humanity, we do ourselves a disservice if we allow our knowledge of those weaknesses to blind us to the fact that their qualities are vastly superior to our own. For a Buddhist, the honourable means primarily the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. We honour the enlightened human source of the Dharma or teaching itself, and those who communicate and exemplify the Dharma. That is, the noble Arhants and the glorious Bodhisattvas, as well as those more developed individuals with whom we are in personal contact. Foremost among the latter is our own teacher. In Tibetan Buddhism, one's teacher is revered as the manifestation within the mandala of the disciple's spiritual life of the Buddha himself. This shows how far Tibetan Buddhists are prepared to go in their concern to protect people from the grave fault of failure to honour the honourable. Quote, "Hypocrisy is to control the senses for the sake of goods and respect. Flattery is to speak pleasant phrases for the sake of goods and respect. Indirect acquisition is to praise another's wealth in order to acquire it. Pressured acquisition is manifest derision of others in order to acquire goods. Desiring profit from profit is to praise previous acquisitions. Repeating faults is to recite again and again the mistakes made by others." End quote. Here we have the opposite of failure to honour the honourable. Hypocrisy and flattery are closely connected with concealment and dissimulation. An example of hypocrisy would be the adoption of the Buddhist lifestyle, whether as a monk in the East or as a Buddhist teacher in the West, for the sake of mundane rewards. An easy, pleasant life, respect, even quite a good living in some cases. We flatter others not only for the sake of goods and respect, or to win their approval, but also out of fear. We're trying to placate them, to put them in a good frame of mind, so as to render them less threatening. In India, flattery is often gross and open. People flatter you to your face in the most outrageous fashion, without the least hesitation or shame. I have been the object of embarrassing effusions of this kind myself when being introduced before delivering a talk. Some recipients of such flattery happily swallow it all, beaming down on the audience and nodding agreement and satisfaction with what is being said about them. This comes from their living in a hierarchical society in which flattery of superiors is regarded as right and proper. Here, flattery is taken not so much as a statement of objective fact, but rather as a clear indication of the recipient's importance and power, and of the flatterer's dependence on that person's favour. In general, the Indian assumption seems to be that if you flatter someone sufficiently, they can't refuse you anything that you ask. A different kind of flattery comes into play when you cast your eye on a picture or some knick-knack and say, "I really do like that," in such a way that the owner feels obliged to give it to you. Then there is the no less ignoble ploy of deprecating something for the same end. "Oh, that doesn't really go with the rest of the decor, does it? It seems hardly worth keeping. It can't have cost you very much. I could find a home for it, though." Another rather sordid tack, Nagarjuna warns us against, is to tell someone how pleased you were with an object they gave you on some previous occasion, how useful it was, and how you could really do with another one just like it, in such a way that they too feel obliged to meet your wish. People have not changed much since Nagarjuna's time. An important Buddhist practice is to rejoice in the virtues of others, but unfortunately many of us prefer to dwell on their faults. Quote, "Repeating faults is to recite again and again the mistakes made by others," end quote, Nagarjuna says. But what are we really trying to achieve by doing that? Clearly we are looking down on the objects of our fault-finding in order to seem or feel superior by comparison. We try to distance ourselves from certain faults by criticising them in others. A lot of humour works like this. The suggestion is that because we can see the folly or frailty of the person who is the butt of the joke and laugh at them, we are free from that folly ourselves. Laughter is sometimes accompanied by a feeling of relief. The relief that comes with recognising a problem and knowing that one is not caught up in it oneself. The wide appeal of certain Zen stories in which a stupid monk is shown up and sometimes woken up by a wise Zen master is no doubt related to this human tendency to laugh at the stupidity of others. In a story, we inevitably identify at some level with one of the characters, and I rather suspect that in the case of such Zen stories, most people will identify with the wise master rather than with the ignorant disciple. Quote, "Through arrogance, a bad lineage, through jealousy, little beauty. A bad colour comes through anger, stupidity, from not questioning the wise." End quote. If you are arrogant, you will eventually be looked down upon. This is the traditional Buddhist view. If you take pride in the eminence of your family or clan, or in modern terms, in your status as a professional, the result under the law of karma and rebirth is that you will be reborn in a low-class family and with low prospects. Jockeying for position is a natural and quite healthy feature of any human, indeed any animal, group. It is the way in which those who are stronger, cleverer, or more capable are enabled to influence the group as a whole. Within a healthy society, those who lack natural abilities at least understand the advantage of their relying for leadership on those who are better qualified. The ego exploits this kind of situation. When someone identifies with the status attached to a position of influence, that ego identification will often find expression in arrogance, in which case they are probably less clever and capable than they think, because arrogance in the long run limits a person's ability to influence others. Arrogance is a presumption of higher status that depends upon treating others as inferior. But if you try to lord it over others, they will resent it and try to turn the tables on you. They might even succeed. Sometimes what appears to be arrogance is not really such, but is a wrong impression due to a misunderstanding or a clash of personalities. For example, within institutions, there is often conflict between those individuals who are more highly organised and those who are less so. The first type will accuse the second of being lazy and unmotivated, while the latter will complain that the more highly organised are forever telling them what to do. This lack of understanding between the two types often manifests as the less organised perceiving the more organised as arrogant. But if you are truly cleverer or more capable, you will try to appreciate ordinary people for what they are able to contribute, rather than looking down on them in a spirit of superiority. Emotions like anger and jealousy also have consequences in terms of our outward appearance. If we are habitually jealous, we begin to look sour, bitter, and resentful. Shakespeare makes Nagarjuna's point better than anyone when in Othello he has Iago express his jealousy of Cassio. Quote, "He hath a daily beauty in his life that makes me ugly." End quote. Jealousy is, in a way, the opposite of arrogance. One is the ego looking down, the other is the ego looking up. It is jealousy that makes us unwilling to rejoice in or even to acknowledge the success, the beauty, or the goodness of other people. We resent others for possessing qualities which we feel we do not possess. In fact, it is jealousy that by its very nature makes it difficult for us to cultivate those qualities ourselves. In the Bodhicharyavatara, Shantideva brings out the sheer irrationality of jealousy. Addressing the would-be bodhisattva, he says, "You desire Buddhahood expressly for living beings. Why do you burn inside on seeing them have some slight honour?" Traditionally, one of the karmic consequences of anger, as of jealousy, is ugliness. Anger tends to distort the features, as one sees in many Renaissance drawings of grotesque faces. Aging also allows our character to find its way into our appearance. Our predominant emotions leave their imprint on the face more and more deeply as we grow older. Oscar Wilde's story, The Picture of Dorian Gray, turns on this fact. A handsome young man keeps a portrait of himself in a locked room, and in a sinister and eerie reversal of the natural order of things, his portrait takes on the effects of ageing while he himself continues to look as young as when it was painted. Though he leads a thoroughly disreputable life, he does not appear to age at all. It is the portrait that slowly, day by day and year by year, shows the terrible consequences of his depravity in its painted features. Quote, "Non-collectedness is inconsiderate irritation arising from illness. Clinging is the attachment of the lazy to their bad possessions. Discrimination of differences is discrimination impeded by desire, hatred, or obscuration. Not looking into the mind is explained as not applying it to anything. Degeneration of respect and reverence for deeds concordant with the practices occurs through laziness. A bad person is regarded as being a spiritual guide pretending to have the ways of the supramundane victor. Yearning is a small entanglement arising from lustful desire. Obsession, a great entanglement arising from desire. Avarice is an attitude of clinging to one's own property. Inopportune avarice is attachment to the property of others. Irreligious lust is the desirous praise of women who ought to be avoided. Hypocrisy is to pretend that one possesses good qualities that one lacks while desiring ill deeds. Great desire is extreme greed gone beyond the fortune of knowing satisfaction. Desire for advantage is to want to be known by whatever way as having superior good qualities." End quote. Discrimination of differences suggests that discrimination is of two kinds. Discrimination can be a positive thing, but seeing differences on the basis of desire, hatred, or obscuration is not. We interpret almost all of our perceptions through conditioned emotional responses that make distinctions where none really exist. It isn't wrong to discriminate, but that discrimination must be, as it were, objective. It must be a seeing of things as they really are. Objective discrimination is, in fact, a very positive quality. At the highest level, it is one of the five wisdoms of the five Buddha mandala, the discriminating wisdom of Amitabha. The pratyavekshana jnana, which sees the uniqueness of things and discriminates them from one another accordingly. Non-collectedness in the first verse here means unmindfulness, and this is a fault that gives rise to a multitude of further faults. Becoming irritable when you are ill is one of them. Non-collectedness also means being scattered and prone to a mindless, inconsiderate hilarity. One aspect of mindfulness is looking into the mind, which is achieved at least partly through applying the mind to a single object, and in this way unifying or integrating one's mental energies. This concentration or harmonization of the mind is the result of a process of weeding out unskillful mental states and developing skillful ones. By looking into the mind, we make it still and calm, and by making it still and calm, we are enabled to look more deeply into it. Thus the process goes on. The first thing that most of us notice when we look into the mind is attachment or entanglement, and on looking more deeply we find that this comes from simple human desires, desires arising out of the perception of certain objects. Attachment arises when we become emotionally dependent on the enjoyment of such objects. Thus desire comes first, leading to a smaller or a greater degree of entanglement, as the case may be. One becomes habituated to the enjoyment of a particular thing and attachment therefore follows. Really addictive or obsessive entanglements are obviously a problem, even from the mundane point of view, but they're not always spiritually the most dangerous. For a practicing Buddhist, there is real danger in small entanglements. It is when we say, "This little fault is not really important in the larger context of my practice," that we need to be on our guard. It is like when one is weeding the garden and it seems too much trouble to dig out a bramble root. It looks harmless when there's only a small shoot, but before one knows it, the garden is overgrown with brambles. In a way, there's no such thing as a small fault, particularly if we do not deal with it straight away, any more than there is any such thing as a small weed. Dismissing small entanglements amounts to not acknowledging the truly enormous obstacle standing between you and what is supposedly your goal. This obstacle is your unwillingness to clear away even quite small entanglements. The Dhammapada puts this well. Do not underestimate evil, thinking it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the spiritually immature person, little by little, fills himself with evil. The opposite attitude is considering as important things that really do not matter very much. Minor regulations become a substitute for spiritual principles. I have known Sri Lankan monks who were notorious for their strict observance of rules that most monks considered relatively unimportant, and who made a nuisance of themselves by insisting on following them to the letter. I remember a lunch held in the library of the Mahabodhi Society headquarters in Calcutta in 1956, for which perhaps 30 or 40 monks, mostly from Ceylon, as it was then, but also from Burma, Thailand and other countries, had turned up. The food did not arrive until 11:40, so there was time to finish by 12 if you ate rather quickly. One of the monks present was known for his punctilious observance of the Vinaya, one of whose minor rules was not to take solid food after midday. He was shoveling food into his mouth as fast as he could, all the time watching the clock on the library wall as its hand crept towards the hour. The moment it struck 12, he dropped his spoon as though it was red hot and looked round as though expecting everyone else to do likewise. But the rest of the monks took no notice of the clock and went on steadily eating, while he surveyed the scene with a very virtuous expression. As he left the room, some of the senior monks just looked at each other and smiled before returning to their meal. Our most obvious attachments are to material things. What Nagarjuna calls avarice is attachment to our own property, a particular shirt, say, or a special chair, or even a house. Similarly, inopportune avarice is attachment to the property of others. We all have a tendency to hang on to things, whether it's a book we have borrowed or a book of our own that we're never going to read, but which we keep anyway. It might seem that these attachments have little to do with our capacity to see into the nature of things, but in fact, they represent our basic resistance to the truth. We cannot see things as they really are, so long as we are attached to them. Nagarjuna has spoken of sexual attachment more than once. Here he warns against desirous praise of women who ought to be avoided. We all know what this means. Such praise is often a topic of masculine conversation, as well as being the staple of much commercial advertising. It comes from not seeing women as they really are, either in the more metaphysical sense or even in simply human terms. Avoiding women might seem an extreme measure, but what it really means is just leaving them alone. I have talked to women about their experience of women's retreats, and they have often said that they found it a great relief to be left alone in this way. They said that normally they did rather enjoy having men around who gave them attention and who perhaps even competed with one another for them. But in same-sex situations, they nevertheless felt a sense of relief, as though a weight had been lifted from them. Attachments occur in every connection, and we can be hypocritical when they clash. For example, we are attached to our faults, but we are also attached to our reputation, as Nagarjuna has already pointed out. In Sanskrit and Tibetan, there are several words that have to be rendered by the one English word, hypocrisy. But here hypocrisy is the precise equivalent that is needed. It means being a whited sepulchre, pretending to be pure and holy while your heart is set on worldly things. The archetypal hypocrite is Tartuffe, the eponymous hero of Molière's famous comedy, from whom derives the word tartufferie, rarely used these days, for consummate hypocrisy in general. The kind of attachment that can never be satisfied is represented by the praters or hungry ghosts. Their neurotic craving is so intense that it is beyond even the possibility of satisfaction. This is the world of drug addiction or intense emotional dependency. Then there is the attachment we have to our own image or wanting to be known by whatever way as having superior good qualities. The words "in whatever way" make it clear why this kind of attachment involves such hard work. We want to be permanently identified with our own ideal image of ourselves, an image which we feel obliged to protect at all costs. Adulation can be a problem for the practicing Buddhist, because the good qualities he or she has developed may end up becoming a cause for complacency and pride on their part. Moral crusaders are like this. They are the holier-than-thou castigators of people's moral shortcomings. In some cases, no doubt, their sense of outrage is justified, but one suspects that many of them are just trying to attract attention to themselves and to make others feel uncomfortable. Some vegetarians, for example, do this to the unfortunate meat-eater. However worthy their work may be, it is the vehemence with which single-issue activists insist on the unique importance of their particular cause that often makes their position suspect. In India, I once met a man, to take another example, who thought that everybody with a social conscience should be helping the lepers, just as he was doing. If you were not doing that, you were morally bankrupt. By identifying strongly with one worthwhile cause, you put yourself in a superior moral position. You create a situation in which you are one of the few who are in the right, which enables you to look down on everyone else. The more importance you give to your cause, the more importance you give to yourself. Quote, attachment to objects is to relate their good qualities in order to acquire them. Fancying immortality is to be unaffected by concern over death. Conceptuality, concerned with approbation, is the thought that, no matter what, others will take one as a spiritual guide due to possessing good qualities. Conceptuality concerned with attachment to others is an intention to help or not help others due to being affected by desire or an intent to harm. End quote. Here Nagarjuna exposes quite a varied collection of human vanities and attachments. Fancying immortality is falsely believing that you will go marching on after death just as you are, that you will survive death more or less intact. This is a form of eternalism, or the overliteral view of rebirth, the idea that you will just wake up on the other side almost exactly as you are on this side, either to be reborn straight away or to select a rebirth at your leisure, or else to spend a few hundred years in some pleasant heavenly realm. This is a deluded view, to put it mildly. No doubt we ought to be concerned about death, which can be a traumatic experience. Most of us are very attached to the things of this world, whether we like to admit it or not, and we are going to suffer when we are torn away from them. So we should be concerned about death and about what will happen to us afterwards. We certainly should not imagine that death will necessarily be simply a smooth transition to some other state. The second verse quoted here refers to the way we casually let drop hints as to our social status when we meet people. There might not be any conscious intention to establish ourselves as superior. We drop such hints almost automatically. In India, people often ask one's caste, or at least they used to, in order to find out where they stand in relation to you. In the West, it is often our job that is the key indicator of our social status. Either way, we feel we need to know these things, and we feel the need to communicate the more favourable indicators of our own status in order to secure as high a place in the social pecking order as we can. Some people do this to a ridiculous degree. My neighbour in Cannes was so late getting from his estate to the film studios that he had to borrow my helicopter. Or, more subtly, of course, my last book didn't do all that well, you know. This tendency can easily find its way into the religious sphere, even into the Sangha, which is presumably the context Nagarjuna has in mind. People say, "You wouldn't believe how damp my cave in the Himalayas was." Or, "A funny thing happened on my second 3-year meditation retreat." Or even, "As the Dalai Lama said to me the last time we met." The hidden intention here is to assert one's spiritual prestige and status. In saying such things, we're not necessarily laying claim to any actual spiritual attainment. We're not openly claiming anything at all. But hints of this kind are worse, in a way, than open bragging. The next verse uncovers more hidden motives. However, being aware of these is no reason for us to condemn ourselves on their account. Our good intentions are often not entirely pure. We may even get a kick out of being altruistic. We're not in it just to help others. We enjoy being in the position of being the helper, the one others look up to. This is only natural. It's very difficult to be entirely disinterested in one's effort to help others. There is almost always something in it for us, even if it is only that we accumulate merit or go to heaven when we die. The fact is that we cannot delay embarking on compassionate action until such time as our motive is completely pure. We have to work on our motivation at the same time that we're engaged in such action. The real danger is that we might be getting out of our altruism some satisfaction that we do not acknowledge. But if we bring mindfulness to bear on our motives, it will help purify them. In the early days of the Western Buddhist Order, people sometimes told me that they did not want to ask for ordination until they could be sure that their motive was perfectly pure. I used to say, "In that case, you'll wait forever." Your motives will never be completely pure. Your motives for committing yourself to the Buddhist path will always be tainted with self-interest. It's enough if, on balance, you feel that your motive is predominantly pure. Going for refuge becomes complete only with enlightenment, But in the meantime, the very fact that we go for refuge has the effect of helping to purify the motive with which we go for refuge. It is the same with meditation. You do not learn all about meditation before you start meditating. You learn a little, and then later, in the light of some practical experience, you correct or modify the ideas that led you to take it up. And so the process goes on. The reasons for which people stay with something, whether it's meditation, Buddhism, or a particular spiritual community, or even a marriage, are sometimes quite different from those with which they began. We are adjusting our direction or our vision or our motive all the time. Quote, dislike is a mind that is unsteady. Desiring union is a dirtied mind. Indifference is a laziness with a sense of inadequacy coming from a listless body. Distortion is for the afflictive emotions to influence body and colour. Not wishing for food is explained as physical sluggishness due to overeating. A very dejected mind is taught to be fearful, faint-heartedness. Longing for desires is to desire and to seek after the five attributes. Harmful intent arises from 9 causes of intending to injure others. Having senseless qualms concerning oneself, friends, and foes in the past, present, and future. Sluggishness is non-activity due to heaviness of mind and body. Drowsiness is sleepiness. Excitement is strong disquiet of body and mind. Contrition is regret for bad deeds, which arises afterwards from grief about them. Doubt is to be of 2 minds about the 4 truths, the 3 jewels, and so forth. Householder bodhisattvas abandon those. Those diligent in monastic vows abandon more. Freed from these defects, good qualities are easily observed. Briefly, the good qualities observed by bodhisattvas are giving, ethics, patience, effort, concentration, wisdom, compassion, and so forth. Giving is to give away one's wealth. Ethics is to help others. Patience is to have forsaken anger. Effort is enthusiasm for virtues. Concentration is unafflicted one-pointedness. Wisdom is ascertainment of the meaning of the truths. Compassion is a mind having one savour, of mercy for all sentient beings. From giving there arises wealth. From ethics, happiness. From patience, a good appearance. From effort in virtue, brilliance. From concentration, peace. From wisdom, liberation. From compassion, all aims are achieved. From the simultaneous perfection of all those 7 is attained the sphere of inconceivable wisdom, the protectorship of the world. End quote. Negative mental states do not simply pass through the mind, leaving no trace behind. They have an effect on us. The mind becomes sullied or stirred up or dull and inert, and this unsatisfactory state of affairs tends to produce further negative mental states. Timidity saps our energy, our confidence, our strength. Eating too much makes us physically and mentally sluggish. All these negative states can also affect the health and general appearance of the body. They are felt in the body, and if they are habitual, the body begins to register them in terms of posture or facial expression, and even in terms of the blood pressure. Note that Nagarjuna recommends that we should never eat so much that our appetite is fully satisfied. Healthy desire, such as the desire for food or for exercise, is positive. The energy in it is necessary for developing a powerful aspiration towards enlightenment. Desire is unhelpful only to the extent that it's caught up in sense objects. Aversion too can be useful, especially when it is directed towards samsara. But generally, our aversion takes the form of hatred or harmful intent, which arises from senseless qualms, i.e. from baseless fears, anxieties and insecurities, which in some cases may amount to paranoia. Contrition is usually reckoned as a positive quality, but here it means the regret that is experienced when one's bad deeds produce unpleasant consequences one had not foreseen. You're not sorry that you have behaved unskillfully. You feel sorry because your bad deeds have not proved successful or have got you into trouble, leaving you with a bad reputation. If you are of two minds about such things as the Four Noble Truths or the Three Jewels, this is because you are unintegrated. The idiom, to be of two minds, is revealing. It acknowledges that you can have, as it were, two minds that operate at one and the same time, or at least that jostle each other for control of your life. Faith, by contrast, implies that you are integrated, that you are of the same mind about such things as the Four Noble Truths and the Three Jewels from one moment to the next. You retain a clear and conscious belief in the values they represent, and it is these values that give you your identity as a Buddhist. Faith is to be distinguished from blind faith. Faith does not exclude honest doubt in the sense of openness of mind or suspension of belief until such time as one has sufficient grounds for making up one's mind. But doubt as a fault does not consist in just being of two minds. It is not really wanting to know what one thinks, and therefore not making a genuine effort to find out. The reason we are so loath to pursue the truth is simple. It is because once we have ascertained it, we might have to take up a definite attitude towards it, or do something about it, or even commit ourselves to its realization. The faults enumerated by Nagarjuna are to be abandoned by both monk and householder. As far as the Bodhisattva path is concerned, the Buddhist householder is expected to work on the elimination of all these negative tendencies in the same way that the monk is, though the monk has other precepts to observe in addition. Nagarjuna is on safe ground when he assures the king that if he takes care of these defects, the corresponding virtues will take care of themselves. The virtues are the opposite of the faults. Once again, though, we must question the practical usefulness of presenting the spiritual life in predominantly negative terms. We have to assume that while the faults themselves are negative, the ancient Indians had the capacity to engage with them in a positive manner. For us, it's surely better to think in terms of cultivating 57 virtues than correcting 57 faults. End of the chapter.